Tonight on Arena, this week's new TV, including spin-off from the worlds of Doctor Who and Sherlock Holmes, and some musical gems you missed in 2025. You are very welcome along to Friday Night's Arena. It's Rick O'Shea with you till 8 o'clock tonight. Text us on 51551, our WhatsApp 0870 32 32 32. You can email arena at rte.ie, and we are on Instagram at rte_arena. We start, as we always do on Friday, with TV reviews. Netflix bring us The Abandons. It's a gritty western set in lawless 1850s America. Follows a widow and her family of adopted orphans who live and farm a ranch in Jackson Hollow. But when the ruthless tycoon Constance Van Ness, played by Gillian Anderson, and her family need their land to broaden their mining business, a brutal feud erupts. On the BBC, Russell T Davies brings us a Doctor Who spin-off, The War Between the Land and the Sea, when an ancient aquatic race known as the Sea Devils rise from the depths to declare war on humanity for their destruction of the oceans. The Unified Intelligence Task Force, or UNIT, scrambles to respond. But George Barclay, a mild-mannered, low-ranking officer played by Russell Tovey, finds himself at the heart of the crisis. And Watson is a new drama on Sky and Now, which follows Sherlock Holmes' friend and confidant, Dr. John Watson, in the aftermath of Holmes' apparent death at the Reichenbach Falls in the hands of Moriarty. Watson, played by Morris Chestnut, opens the Holmes Clinic in modern-day Pittsburgh, a cutting-edge practice where he applies his deductive skills to diagnose rare and baffling medical cases. Where have we heard that before? Jen Gannon and Chris Wasser have watched all three and join me now. We'll start with Netflix. They've jumped on board the Renaissance of the Western. This week they're launching The Abandons, set in 1850s Washington State. Jen, tell us about this one.
Yeah, I mean, look, you would think the Gillian Anderson and the Lena Headey, you've got two marquee names there, two acting powerhouses that all should denote some kind of quality that we're injecting into this series. But if the modern televisual landscape has taught us anything, it's the fact that names mean nothing now. I mean, a name is just another bauble to direct you to watch a show rather than another show on another streamer. And I feel like we're here every week looking at shows that it sounds like we've made them up, because it's like a genre and a star mashed together, and then we talk about them and then we ultimately forget about them. And that's, I think, how we've arrived at The Abandons, which is created by Kurt Sutter, who is responsible for Sons of Anarchy. So that denotes the tone that we're going for here. But also, it's a really strange show. I started laughing at the initial, just the clip art imagery at the start of the title, The Abandons. And it had this certain style to it. And that certain style is something that would be on the telly at 6 o'clock on a Saturday in 1991. This is the kind of filler show that you would have endured because you were waiting to see Baywatch. That's the type of style that this show is. And I don't know if we're nostalgic for that. It's a real forgettable plot boiler. So it sounds.
Is it in Dr. Quinn Medicine Woman territory?
It's like a rough, tough, gritty version of Dr. Quinn Medicine Woman. There's a lot of women in long dresses riding around on horses and being salty with each other. Okay. So it revolves around two families, very different backgrounds, which is like their take on the Hatfields and the McCoys. So on the one end of town, you've Constance Van Ness, who's Gillian Anderson. She's the matriarch of this very admired clan. She's a power player and she wants to expand her family's empire across the region. And then she runs into Fiona Nolan, who's Headey, and she refuses to give in to the ploy, to Constance's ploy for her land. And then Constance's investors are growing really impatient. So they end up doing dirty tricks like setting fires, releasing livestock, and generally leaning on Fiona's household, aka the orphans. So Fiona has her own makeshift family of abandoned adopted children who are very loyal to her, and they're all archetypes. They're all cut out cardboard characters. So they include the kind-hearted Elias, the undervalued Albert, the very loyal Lila Bell, and the very faithful daughter Dahlia, who's played by Diana Silvers. Now, Fiona is also Irish, mm-hmm. or Irish. She's very that. So she barrels around the
place.
There
is a big difference.
Swearing a lot. She's pushing people out of the way. For, in my mind, it was like they threw Peggy and Mike and Calamity Jane into a blender. And that's the smoothie that you're, the resulting smoothie is Fiona. So, I mean, sometimes Lena Headey gets the accent, but mostly she's happy just to dial up that stage Irishness to 100%. And it's that kind of show. So you're either going to go with that or not.
Okay, let's let you have a listen to a little bit of it. This is Mrs. Van Ness and her son Garrett visiting the mayor to discuss the obstruction of four homes in Jackson Hollow. So it's Gillian Anderson and Lucas Till as the Van Nesses, and a man who is contractually obliged to be in every single TV show, Patton Oswalt, playing the mayor.
Mrs. Van Ness, some service I can provide?
Mr. Mayor, our West Hill and Summit mines are down 27%.
And my primary associate, the esteemed Mr. Vanderbilt. Well, if Cornelius sees that one of his investments is losing steam, his concern becomes contagious.
That vein of silver running through Jasper Hollow is our most timely solution.
Well, generous offers have been made to all four families in the Hollow. No doubt, common sense will settle in.
We cannot rely on the arbitrary sense of the common, Victor. We all know that without the expansion of Van Ness Mines, Angel's Ridge will slide back into the mud.
We do not want that.
No, we do not. And so our pursuit of the Hollow will continue.
Okay, Chris, as Jen mentioned, the creator here is Kurt Sutter. He's the guy behind Sons of Anarchy. Does the plotting and the writing and the structure measure up in any way to that?
No, not at all. I'd like to see what The Abandons was going to be before it was literally abandoned by its creator. So apparently this has been cooking up in Kurt Sutter's mind since before Sons of Anarchy premiered. So for 20 odd years, he wanted to make this, you know, gangster epic, or, you know, the birth of, you know, the mafia in America's Old West. So he's had 20 years to prepare for this. He brought it to Netflix, and off the back of Sons of Anarchy being a huge hit, the suits at Netflix said, 10 episodes, an hour each, here's all the money you need, go for it. They came in then as the show was nearing completion in terms of its production, and apparently they had a look at the first two episodes, and the first episode was originally feature length, and apparently Netflix said, that won't do at all, we need to split this thing into two. That would have meant shooting additional scenes. Kurt Sutter wasn't in the mood to do that, so he left his own show, leaving the people behind, including director Otto Bathurst, to, you know, shoot what needed to be shot, ditch some sequences, maybe some characters, some subplots, and piece together what they could. So a show that was originally supposed to be 10 one-hour episodes turned into a series that's actually 7 episodes, with episode lengths varying. So some of them are about half an hour long, some of them are about 40 minutes. What I'm trying to say in a very round, a long way, is that this thing is all over the place. And there's a sense that, you know, it's like being handed a book where some of the pages are missing, and you can see the tears, and never more so when it comes to Patton Oswalt's character, who would have heard there playing the mayor. There's a sequence in episode 2 involving, let's just say, the end of Patton Oswalt's character that doesn't make any sense at all, and we never really come back to it. And that becomes a thing as you watch more of it. You see an action sequence, a battle sequence at one point, another involving all the men in the town going off to kill this bear, another involving Brian F. O'Byrne. Brian F. O'Byrne is in this. I think the whole series should actually revolve around him. Another involving his dog that we never come back to. There's just holes all over the place. And that would be forgivable if the things the characters actually said to one another, you know, were decent, if the dialogue was decent. But I found a lot of the time here, and we probably shouldn't be surprised with Kurt Sutter, the dialogue is just out of time with the setting, and it's very on the nose. I mean, one of the first lines you actually hear in this series is Nick Robinson's Elias telling his mother, Lena Headey, that Constant Van Ness's tyranny is getting worse. Now, I'm okay if it says that the character's tyranny is getting worse on the, you know, on the treatment. That shouldn't be in the dialogue, Rick.
Let's take another clip, just so people can have another sense of what it's about. Tricia Van Ness sees her mother, her brother Willem, watching one of the orphans, Dahlia, who is minding the horses with Isaac, and runs over to introduce them. This is Aisling Franciosi and Toby Hemingway starring as Tricia and Willem, with Diana Silvers as Dahlia and Michael Ornstein as Isaac.
Dahlia Teller, there's someone who...
Tricia! Hey, Isaac. I believe my mama's horse should be getting your full attention.
Palomino's getting a proper tending.
He's a bit skittish. He had a harrowing night.
Right. Heard you had a rustler problem down at the ranch.
Maybe it was a rustler problem, sheared the Palomino's hoof.
You making some affront against my family?
Isaac didn't mean anything by it.
Right. Just a mindless mutter.
Let's go.
Yeah, well, it best not happen again. So I do not take kindly to disparaging accusations. Especially for some dirty little Jew.
Well, we all know you had nothing to do with that horror last night. The attack required a fair amount of brains.
Jen, we talked about Taylor Sheridan, Man Behind Yellowstone, 1883, and about how there's this revival in Westerns happening in the US at the moment. Presumably, this is only going to be part of a continuing revival across, you know, lots of different streamers. Does this compare to any of his stuff?
I mean, no. You can attract... Right. I just don't think you can attract a Yellowstone audience by throwing a Stetson on a female actor. You just can't. And it's not Deadwood. You know, it certainly is not Deadwood. Like, there is no comparison between those shows. And I think maybe we're going on the wrong track here. I would like to see somebody of Gillian Anderson's power, prestige, take on like a gothic Western, like something like Faulkner or something like that. Get really down to it. But they're not doing that. They're appealing to this base level of what they think the past was, or what they think the epicness of America was, in this way that the UK were taken over around the time of Brexit, of this imaginary fantasy land that the UK was, you know, post-World War II or pre-World War II. This is the way America has gotten now, and this is the stories that they're selling themselves. And there's just no substance there. There's no reality there. I know one of the characters within the Orphans, Albert, played by Lamar Johnson, he's black, so you have a little bit of the racist tension coming in, but not enough. You don't see enough of the Native Americans at no. all, really. There's storylines there, but like Chris says, they're completely dropped because we don't know what happens. There's just plot holes everywhere. So it's just very unbalanced, and with no feeling or no intention to it. You can hear the line deliveries there. It's like they're, you know, scrolling through their phones. The younger cast especially, I think, suffer from that fate where it's like they're acting in a teen romance or a teen drama rather than giving this what it probably needs, that little bit more heft. But in saying that, they're working with very poor dialogue to begin with.
Okay, let's go for stars.
Oh God, one. It's a one for me, I'm sorry.
Chris?
I might go a bit extra just for, I would like to see a Western built around Brienne F. O'Byrne. Aisling Franciosi does her best to make a three-dimensional character out of nothing. I think if you hang around Lena Headey's Irish accent long enough, there's a Stockholm syndrome there. It almost starts to convince you that it might actually be good. There's something here. I would like to see what the original version was going to be, but unfortunately we've ended up with the soap opera version of The Abandoned, so it's two stars.
Okay, second up tonight, the BBC and a Doctor Who spin-off from the acclaimed screenwriter Russell T. Davies. The War Between the Land and the Sea is about ancient sea creatures that rise from the oceans to wreak havoc on mankind. Chris, are you a Whovian and did you like it?
I'm not a Whovian, so I was coming at this thing. I watched about 10 minutes of it and then I paused it and thought I might need to do a bit of homework here. You know, when they started mentioning the Doctor and the fact that maybe we've seen these sea devils before, I thought, well, I haven't. But these sea devils have been a part of, you know, the Doctor Who lore maybe since the 1970s. But Russell Davies has decided that, you know, there should be a story about how, you know, this was their planet first and, you know, they decide to emerge from, you know, the Earth's oceans and seas one day and say, and rivers one day and say, you know, we want it back. So the story takes place, we follow the story through the eyes of this character, Barclay, played by Russell Tovey. And he is just this, you know, bumbling everyman character who's actually working in the administrative department for the Unified Intelligence Task Force. They are an agency, a government agency that basically investigates and combats extraterrestrial threats on Earth, except this isn't an extraterrestrial threat, it's coming from the sea. He should be booking taxis for the people in UNIT. But for some reason that's too complicated to explain, he ends up replacing some higher level employee, which means that when these sea devils start to pop up, he ends up in a position that he really shouldn't be, you know, with the government, with the army. He makes communication with the species that then we go on to call the Homo Aqua race. And long story short, Rick, they make their appearance all over the globe. You know, this government thinks that they're meeting secretly with these sea people. They may they pop up all over the earth. A big conference is held on the Thames where, you know, the government heads are going to finally actually have a conversation with these fish people. But they don't want to talk to the government heads. They want to talk to Barclay because they realize that all they're going to get from the government types, you know, are empty, hollow responses, scripted stuff that, you know, isn't from the heart. With Barclay, who, you know, was respectful when he actually saw one of these creatures dead, they realize this guy is human. This guy has feelings. We want to talk to him.
Okay, this is from the series. This is Barclay finding himself on the unit jet to Spain. He's worried he has mistakenly replaced another more senior member of the team, which he has, and he reaches out for help. This is Russell Tovey and Henry Knott.
I replaced him only one time back in 2020. His wife was having a baby. It was premature and he had to rush off. And I just happened to be there. So all I had to do was answer his phone, which didn't even ring. And so that was that. But then I went on file as Roger Trevithick's replacement.
How is the baby?
Yeah, the baby was fine. But the thing is, I just got stuck on the list in HR. Roger Trevithick's replacement. I get like memos. I mean, there's one time I even got tickets to Japan and I'd email him. I'd say, look, I'm not Roger Trevithick's replacement.
So?
So I'm not Roger Trevithick's replacement. Oh, great, Ted.
You're dead.
Look, don't talk to me.
And I didn't show you anything.
Yeah, but what do I do? I work in transport. I just booked the taxis.
Chris, there's a little bit of Norman wisdom about him sometimes, isn't there? There's just a tiny little
there is, and there it's like a bit of Whitnail and I, like we've gone on holiday by mistake. That's what that really felt like to me.
Is this a really clever way, though, of using the everyman character to maybe hook in people completely, for whom the bigger idea might not necessarily appeal to them?
Completely, because I'm not a Doctor Who person either. My knowledge would like start with Sylvester McCoy and end with like David Tennant. That's the last Doctor I cared about. But I get where Russell T. Davies is coming from, because he needs Russell Tovey to be our eyes, to be our way into this world. And he's a great character to have alongside because he's as clueless as we are. And he shouldn't be there. And you always feel like that in the biggest moments of your life. I suppose you feel like, I'm not equipped for this. So it's a very natural reaction. And I think Russell T. Davies is a great writer when it comes to the ordinary. He's great at capturing that, and there's a sense that that overwhelmingness of this international affair is brought back home by the fact that he's with his family and his estranged wife and his teenage daughter are there along with him, and they're boosting his confidence but also criticising him, taking down a peg or two. And that's relatable, and I found that side of things more intriguing in a way. And I think the thing about it is Russell T. Davies, his work, say something like Years and Years or It's a Sin or Cucumber, they veer on the side of polemical. They have to, because there's messages, there's things, important details and subjects, philosophical ideas that he wants to get out there. And I think that works well when it's done in a normal dramatic sense, when it's done through characterization and plotting in familiar terms. But when you're verging on sci-fi, when this is sci-fi basically, and when it's about world building and something unique, I think with the episodes that I've seen, we've only seen two, it can feel a little bit preachy then, because what you have is just the Homo aquas versus the humans, and a lot of it takes place in kind of like parliament setting or a courtroom setting. So it's them setting their arguments against each other, and that can be quite tiresome if you're settling down to watch something that you think has a Doctor Who flavour and it's going to be Saturday night family entertainment. It can feel a bit tiresome when it's stretched over these two episodes. Initially, it needs more action, is basically what I'm trying to say.
And just maybe to tie into that, Chris, so this is the BBC, and I don't think this is a co-production with Disney the same way the last Doctor Who series was. So they don't have anything like the money that streamers spend on drama. You need to be believable when you are creating worlds like this. So does it work on terms of their construction of their world and the special effects?
I think so, yeah. There's a very effective sequence in episode two where the Homo Aquas basically show the humans, we're not messing about here, and we'll show you how easily we can start a war. And it isn't every day, you know, this will broadcast on Sunday night in the BBC, and it isn't every Sunday night that you see, you know, the end of the world starting. in London. You know, there's an apocalyptic plastic storm and it is exactly as it sounds, Rick. And I thought it was actually very well done. I mean, maybe there's a reason why the rest of the series actually takes place, why the rest of the series sometimes resembles, you know, one meeting after another, you know, because maybe they don't have the budget to be having those storm sequences over and over, all the action stuff, basically. But I like that. And I do hope that there's a bit more of it, because at the minute, all I can see is I am enjoying Russell Tovey's performance and I'm enjoying, you know, there's a sly sense of humor there that I quite like, but all I can see is influences at the minute. You know, it's tipping its hat to, I think it likes to think that it's a rival, you know, another story where an ordinary civilian is brought in to kind of bridge that communication gap between one species and another. There's a lot of Avatar there. I realize the Sea Devils have been around since the 70s, but they're every day they're looking more and more like James Cameron's Space Smurfs. And I think there's also a little bit of The Shape of Water there, because there's this lovely bond, and we don't really know where it's going to go, between Barclay and Gugu Mbatha-Raw. Salt being the leader or the spokesperson for the fish people at this point, they have this instant bond, this connection, and it's such a big connection that you even have Barclay's ex-wife jealous of it. So you wonder where they're going to go with that. Now, I don't need to see a Shape of Water, you know, connection emerge, but there is
another
something.
Another sexy fish, can we take this?
But there is something there. But maybe we do need to see a bit more action.
Okay, give me some stars.
I am liking this. I'm liking what Russell Tovey is doing. You know, he's maybe overdoing the bumbling everyman bit a bit too much, but I think he is good company. It's a nice performance from Russell. I think some of the social commentary, everything's in block capitals. It's like, we get it. We're killing the planet and this is what will happen if we keep killing it. It's a bit, you know, it's just a bit heavy handed, basically. But I had fun with it. We only saw two episodes. There's a big cliffhanger. I kind of want to see what happens next. I'll stick with it for now. 3 stars.
Okay, Jen.
And I like a righteous barnstorming Russell T Davies when he's in that mode. And I think that's what he needs to give to Gugu Mbatha-Raw's character, Salt. She's representative of the species, so she has a lot of exposition to do, but I need her to do something else, something more, and that will be really gripping. I think it needs to be action-based now for the rest of it to hook people in. But I do think, you know, Russell Tovey's character is trying to do the right thing, and that's what the series is trying to do. It's trying to lay out the like climate change and the dilemma of climate change, and it might feel like eating your vegetables a bit along with your fish, maybe, but I mean, it's not necessarily a bad thing, so I'll give it a 3.
Okay, finally tonight we have another sort of spin-off series, this time Watson on Sky. It picks up the Sherlock Holmes story but moves the detective's sidekick Dr. Watson into the modern era, where he uses his deductive powers to solve difficult medical cases. Jen, explain this to me.
Well, it's House, isn't it? Like, I mean, this is as much of a Sherlock spin-off as it is a House revival. So screenwriter and showrunner Craig Sweeney, he can't get enough of Sherlock Holmes, it would seem, because he worked on the Johnny Lee Miller, Lucy Liu effort, Elementary. And this is attempting, I guess, to cram that fastidious nature of Sherlock and Holmes into a medical procedural drama. And he is Dr. Watson after all, so let him be a doctor, I suppose. But like, I mean, the setup is House. Are we, as a TV watching entity, suffering from a house-shaped hole in our lives? Is that what has happened here? I think we've had enough House to last us a lifetime, to be honest. And you can watch House right now on Netflix if you wanted to. Like, it's all there. So I don't really understand why we have gone from what could be a spin-off detective series and putting him in this hospital where he is now trying to, I don't know, sort out crazy medical happenings. It's a really strange one to me. Basically, when you see when we join Watson, you see that maybe that he's been scuppered by Moriarty, and then he wakes up in a hospital and his associate named Shin Will Johnson, who literally is like he came from the Guy Ritchie Sherlock. Mm-hmm. Like, this is all over the map. So he informs Watson that his late friend was a very wealthy man and has left him a fortune, and he's going to use it to set up this diagnostic clinic. And that's the house of it all, because he gathers this team, this ragtag team of doctors, to start all this diagnosing. None of them are Billy from Neighbours, unfortunately.
We will only know it's not going to be House as well if somebody has lupus at some point.
Yeah, yeah.
Let me play something from you. This is following the incident at the Swiss waterfall, Dr. John Watson waking up in hospital with the wonderfully titled Shinwell Johnson, who has bad news for him. This is Morris Chestnut as Watson and Richie Coster as Johnson.
We've lost him, Gav. We've lost Mr. Holmes. I was trying to help him, Shimura. I went into water after to go get him. And I was close, and I thought.
I know. You were the best friend Mr. Holmes ever had. So don't you go punishing yourself, because I won't have it. We will take time later, and we will remember the man properly. But they're going to want to have a look inside your thick skull now you're up. Hey, did you know he was loaded?
Holmes lives in a two-bedroom flat on Baker Street.
Might have been quiet about it. But Holmes had the bees and the honey to look after us both. Seems the man had a vision. Vision of you practicing medicine again. He's funded a clinic for you to run. You hire your choice of medics. There'll even be a certain former heart man around to help you look after the place.
Former? You're on Sherlock's will.
He's paying me to be your aid.
Okay, on top of all of this, Chris, we have a group of other doctors that he has hired who are part of this as well, including Peter Mark Kendall, who's playing both Adam and Stephen Croft, which one of our producers here took a very long time to figure out. It was one actor playing two parts. They're twin brothers and doctors. It is a strange one on top of an increasingly strange situation, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I'm only allowing Michael B. Jordan to get away with that this year. We're playing two roles in the same setup. Even Robert De Niro tried it and it was just too gimmicky. It's very gimmicky here. They're twin brothers. They're both infectious disease specialists. So they both work in the same field. They've both been hired by Watson to be part of a superstar, you know, detective medical team, but they're both very different. And one of them apparently is not too happy with the other because they are now getting married to the other brother's girlfriend. Who does that? Mm-hmm. So instantly you're thinking these aren't real people. Watson also has his own neurologist working as part of his team, and he's not being honest with her about his brain injury, which is clearly getting worse. I mean, he's actually developed an addiction to pills, which Shimwell brings to him illegally. So there's a whole other storyline, but also a storyline lifted again from Sherlock. You know, it's not Sherlock who has the addictions this time, it's Watson. There's a lot going on here. And if that wasn't enough, you also have Watson's ex-wife, the wife that he basically left in Pittsburgh to go and run around after criminals and run around after Moriarty in London. She is Dr. Mary Morstan, played by Rachel Eisen. And she brings Watson his first patient in episode one. And his first patient basically thinks that she is dying from fatal insomnia. And what she wants Watson to do is to help her deliver her baby so that she can die. She thinks she's going to, you know, that's what her father had. It's what killed her dad. But of course, anyone who comes into this clinic saying, I have this disease that's going to kill me, you know you're going to find out that they have a different disease altogether and that everything's going to be all right.
Or a third disease.
Yeah, and that everything's going to be okay for them, you know, because it's all about the bigger story. The bigger story being that Randall Parks, Moriarty, is on the sideline cooking up some sort of revenge. And we also have to ask ourselves, and I don't think I'm really spoiling anything here, because this series is actually on its second season in America. It's only getting to Ireland and England now. And American audiences have had the treat of seeing the actual Sherlock return to it. And in America, they're getting to see Robert Carlyle play Sherlock Holmes. I want to see Robert Carlyle play Sherlock Holmes. Yep. So despite the fact that this series is a little bit messy for now, I think I'm willing to stick it out just to see Robert in action.
I want to see how he comes back. Yeah, it's like, what have you done? This is not the medical center I wanted.
No, not at all.
Okay, I have to go for stars. So go with Chris.
Look, I think Morris Chestnut, a man with the best name in television, he brings a warmth and a charisma and a likability, charm, everything to this character. He would almost keep you watching, but it's quite derivative. There's nothing here that we haven't seen before. All I can hear is writing whenever the characters talk to one another. And the mystery, they're so far ahead of us with the medical mysteries that I just found myself sometimes just nodding along and not really understanding what was going on. So look, it's maybe 3 or 4 stars for Morris Chestnut, but 2.5 for the show.
Okay, Jen.
Oh, it's a solid 2. And they're both for Morris Chestnut. He's such a suave performer and he's too good for this Frankenstein's monster of a show, for real. I mean, there is no characterization here. I mean, you have Cozy TV, like called The Midwife or Midsummer Murders, but they have some degree of care put into them with characterization, with plot lines. This really doesn't. It's, you know, the TV equivalent of the tree falling in the forest. But now I kind of want to see Robert Carlyle come out of that forest.
I'm sorry I've spoiled that now.
Question is, are you willing to wait a season and a half for it? Okay, thank you very much, Jane Gannon and Chris Wasser. The Abandons is streaming on Netflix. The War Between the Land and the Sea begins on BBC One this Sunday, and Watson is available on Sky and Now. And you're listening to Friday Night's Arena. So many people contacted us after last night's interview with Joseph O'Connor about Irish cultural locations in Rome. And we did mention that the Casa della Cultura Irlandese, in collaboration with the Italian Cultural Institute in Dublin, is presenting an evening of Irish and Italian culture on the 10th of December. Just like the events artist Eve Parnell curated in Rome, there's a huge demand for tickets, so they have added a few more and they're now currently available, probably for the next 10 seconds or so. You can find them all on Eventbrite. You just need to look under Casa della Cultura Irlandese. And now, tonight, in lieu of album reviews, and since it's coming close to the end of the year, we've asked two of our music reviewers to remind us of a few albums that they really rated this year, which might have flown under all of our radars. They are the hidden gems of 2025. Zara Hederman and Owen Glacken are with us. And they're also going to tell us about some classic albums they've been rediscovering recently. But we're going to start with the hidden gems first. Zara, where do you want to go? Hayden Pettigo. Tell me.
Yeah, this was a complete discovery for me this year. I was struck by the artwork of this, which is really beautiful. So the title of this is I'll Be Waving As You Drive Away, which Little House on the Prairie fans will recognise as an episode title. So essentially, he's a Texas-born fingerstyle guitarist. And on this album, he worked with Scott Hirsch, who's well known for working with William Tyler, who's very similar in vein musically. But with this one, he actually gathered a band of like an electric piano, a pedal steel, soft percussion and some strings, and the first time I listened to this I was just completely in love, so much so that when I listened to it I immediately looked up to see if he was playing Dublin, and luckily he was. He was playing in the Grand Social and it was a sold out show, and everyone, I've never seen a post-COVID audience so attentive. Everyone was just completely enrapt at his playing, because it's just completely mesmerising how he just plays so beautifully. He's inspired as well by John Fahey, so that's kind of like the realm we're like talking about, also Robbie Basho and Led Zeppelin. But if anyone is feeling in any way stressed with Christmas, I find this is just a really beautiful album to kind of ground you and to get lost in.
Yeah, you can imagine an enrapt audience with this. Mm-hmm. Let's have a listen to something from it. This is the track I'll Be Waving As You Drive Away. Yeah, that is properly gorgeous. That's Hayden Pettigo, and the album is called I'll Be Waving As You Drive Away. Owen, where do you want to start? Side 4 Collective?
Yeah, I suppose it's not that hidden a gem to our listeners this week, because it is in fact the album of the week for Radio 1, which was great to see. Yeah, Side 4 Collective. Now, if anybody who was a fan of anything in the Irish music scene in the 2000s and you know, beyond, will have heard certainly or seen Dave Hingerty playing the drums. He seemed to be everywhere on everything. He was with The Frames, Josh Ritter in the Royal City Band, Mark Erie, Keela, Brona Gallagher. List goes on and on and on. So what he's done here is that he's invited all of his musical pals in, well, certainly a lot of them. What he does is he records these interesting, you know, kind of quirky drum patterns. He invites his mates in and kind of lets them use that as the scaffolding on which they can build whatever they like. And he encourages them to get experimental. And he talks about how his friends are, you know, often maybe feel the need to write in more sort of commercial forms. And he says, scrap all that. Let's get weird, you know. So that's what he's doing. And here there's a host of guests. You've got Liam O'Mahony, Niamh Regan, Colm Quirney, used to release records as Q for Q fans out there. And he builds these great records, and the through line through it, of course, is his drumming. And usually I don't particularly listen out for great drum sounds on albums. Sometimes they're so unavoidably great. But here, producers should be listening. This is how drums should sound, you know, not to tell anybody how to do their job. So that's what we've got here. We've got this great, and you know, with albums where there's different voices playing around, obviously sometimes you can feel like you're getting a bit lost, or where am I, what album is this? You don't find that. It's this coherent through line, his drumming, and really some quite experimental, gorgeous stuff that comes out of it, yeah.
Okay, we've picked this to play from it. It's Side 4 Collective, and it is the Radio 1 album of the week this week when we were still. This track is called The Prize. Okay, that's Side 4 Collective, and that's Niamh Regan on vocals. And that's called The Prize, Zara. Next up, Hannah Francis.
Yeah, so this completely knocked my socks off. So she is, I suppose, for fans of like Aldous Harding, Dirty Projectors, John Newsome and Jim O'Rourke, and especially Grizzly Bear. And actually, Daniel Rawson from the band features on quite a lot of these songs and brings his kind of very idiosyncratic sensibility to these songs. But otherwise, like, it's a remarkably lively theatrical album that has everything from like avant-garde, like prog rock, jazz, rock, folk, and within it, like, the songs are just, they just throw you around the room listening to it. And it follows on from her album Keeper of the Shepherd, where she was exploring themes of grief and familial trauma. And when we hear it, like, the sound, the music and arrangements are so, so big, and you wonder how she's going to be able to compete with that. And then her vocals are just absolutely incredible, and she's got great range where she can sing kind of conventionally but then does some really interesting vocal layering and acrobatics. And for me, this, the first time I heard it, was just a complete show stopper. I really, really loved it.
Okay, I haven't heard her before either, so let's have a listen to this. This is Hannah Francis, and it's the title track. It's called Nested in Tangles. Hannah Francis, Nested in Tangles. That's another one of our choices on our Hidden Gems and Rediscoveries section here tonight on the programme. Owen Varrow's The Worlds That I Knew. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so again, similar to Side 4 Collective, this is a collaboration album. And it's Varrow, the two Varrow ladies are Lucy Azcanaga from France and Consuela Nerei Brecci from Italy, and I do hope I pronounced your name right, Consuela, excuse me if I didn't. So they're two violin players and vocalists themselves, and they came together with this mutual love of trad music. And this is now their second album, and you can tell by the lineup on this album that they've really earned the respect, shall we say, of their peers in the Irish traditional world, because it's kind of a who's who of folk and trad. What they do, it's all old songs, and what is different and unique about their versions is that they are immersed now in trad music, but they come from jazz backgrounds, classical backgrounds, they've got baroque chops, and so their arrangements are what give these songs their new fresh coat of paint. And also the song selection, some of these songs I knew, some of them I didn't. There's a Innie Kay does a gorgeous version of Heather on the Moor, which I knew the song, but then there's a song like Lancome's Ian Lynch sings a song written by a guy called John Shiel called Sweet Liberty, which was written in the 1800s, which is this amazing anti-racist song. And the lyrics, you know, I know it's the trite thing to say about folk music, oh, isn't it amazing that they had the same problems 200 years ago? But it is that's the magic and power of folk music. And those messages come through. And again, what gets them that this fresh coat of paint and this gorgeous coherence through the album is, of course, the Varrow ladies themselves.
Okay, let's play that. This is Varrow, and this is the version of Heather on the Moor with an artist who was here with us on Arena a few weeks ago. Innie Kay.
Down some miles from home, among the beautiful blooming heather, and it's heather on the moor.
That's Varrow from the album The World That I Knew, and that's Heather on the Moor with Innie Kay on vocals. We'll have some more of the hidden gems that you might have missed in 2025 after these. Friday night's Arena, you are listening to Hidden Gems and Rediscoveries of 2025 with Zara Hederman and Owen Glacken. Zara, Destroyer's album, Dan's Boogie, tell me about that.
Yeah, so this is one of my favourite bands, I think, of all time. I've literally travelled far and wide to see them. I was in Berlin only a couple of weeks ago to see them because they're, in my eyes, one of the best live bands, and that is because they have an incredible live band which are captured on this album, but also their frontman Dan Behar is often likened to being a new Bob Dylan. He is in his 50s, so he's kind of close to Bob Dylan's age, but that's because he has like the most incredibly descriptive, vivid lyrics that are also really ambiguous but also hilarious. On this album we have a line like, a priest mistakes me for a priest in a stream of consciousness flow. But the band are just incredibly opulent in how they sound. Like, we've got great like synth parts, they have a bit of a new wave kind of feel to them, and they're just really maximalist. But on this they brought in some kind of new stories and sounds. Like, there's one song, Bologna, which has this kind of noir feel to it. And they're just albums that each time I listen back to them, I hear something new in them and love something new in them. So when this came out in March, I think through the 9 songs, each of them have been my favourite going through my listens. I will say his vocals are Marmite. So I've tried to get so many people into him. And on recording, people don't always love it. But when you see it live, it all makes sense.
Okay, well, let's take a taste of the Marmite. This is Destroyer, and the album is called Dan's Boogie. And this is the track Bologna. That explains things. And we should point out his is the second vocal on that and not the first one, because that features Fiverr as well on that. I do want to get to the rediscoveries. I'd like to get one from each of you. So, Owen, you've chosen an album you kind of rediscovered this year, the Springsteen and the Seeger Sessions Band from the Live in Dublin album.
Yeah, specifically the Live in Dublin album. So in the kind of mid-2000s, he went off and he spent a couple of days in a barn with a load of fiddles and accordions and gospel singers, and he made the Seeger Sessions album, which was a tribute, of course, to Pete Seeger. He came to Dublin. The first night of the tour, I remember, was in March, and then it was amazing, and then he rolled back around in November. And at that point, the set list had evolved. He brought in his own songs again. The arrangement had evolved, the band had really coalesced, and it was this incredible beast of a thing. Thankfully, he documented it on the Live in Dublin album. And it was the backdrop at the time, really, you have to remember, was in the mid-2000s. This was sort of he was trying to lead a new folk revival, which wasn't really happening at the time, to be fair, in the mainstream anyway. And it was a backdrop against, the political unrest in America at the time, the Iraq War. And so going back to those old Seeger songs, those old protest songs, seemed to be the most direct way he could make his statement. And this album, I think, is the greatest testament of that era for him. And when people think of his folk albums, you think of Nebraska and Ghost of Tom Joad and Devils in Dust. This is very much in the, this is the sort of the uber version of those folk albums. And it's incredible. And some of the versions of those songs, for me, are definitive versions. I think Atlantic City is one of the better versions. He does this gorgeous waltz time version of If I Should Fall Behind, which is in itself has become a very popular wedding song. But people need to dig into this waltz version, because it's even more wedding-y than the original, And it's amazing. My own brother, who had tutored me in the game when it comes to Springsteen fandom, said to me the other day, I forgot that album existed. So that's why I thought, it's worth reminding people this exists.
All right, let's play something from it. This is from the album recorded live in Dublin in 2007 at the Old Point Theatre. How Can a Poor Man Stand Such Times and Live? And you'll have to listen to the album to find out a little bit more of that. That is Springsteen and the Seeger Sessions Band live in Dublin in 2007, and him doing How Can a Poor Man Stand Such Times and Live. One more, it's a rediscovery. Zara, you're going for John Cale.
Yeah, I'm going for Slow Dazzle, which turned 50 in March. And it turned out 2025 became the bit of a year of John Cale after his collaboration with Charlie XCX. So a lot of Gen Z fans in his fan base now. I just absolutely adore this album. So it's his fifth solo album in the space of 5 years, and to me it's a bit of an outlier, because he kind of goes back a bit more to like the romantic 50s pop stuff with like I'm Not the Loving Kind, even doing a really harrowing Heartbreak Hotel cover, which I think is one of the best covers of all time. But then I also found this album so poignant this year in particular, because it opens with a song, Mr. Wilson, which is his own John Cale's tribute to Brian Wilson and how much he loved him, and he tried to like imitate the really warm, gorgeous Californian kind of harmonies of the Beach Boys music. And obviously when he passed away in June, it became all the more relevant.
Okay, let's play that. This is from John Cale's Slow Dazzle. It's Mr. Wilson. John Cale, Mr. Wilson finishes us out for tonight. Zara Hederman and Owen Lacken, thanks so much for joining us this evening. Before we finish out tonight's arena, during the course of tonight's show, the sad news is broken that Frank Gehry, one of the most formidable talents in the history of American architecture, has died today at his home in Santa Monica following a brief respiratory illness. He was 96. Gehry arrived in LA as a directionless teenager just after World War II and went on to become one of the most famous and one of the most influential architects in the world over a prolific 6-decade career. The most recognisable of his many masterpieces and the building he'll be most remembered for is the incredible Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao. Set in what had been a barren industrial city on the northern coast of Spain, this spectacular titanium-clad museum was an international sensation when it opened in 97, helping to re-energise the city and making Gehry the most celebrated American architect since Frank Lloyd Wright. That is it from Arena for this week as well. Produced tonight by Sheila O'Callaghan. Paula Shields was our researcher. Ollie Hamilton is the broadcast coordinator on the programme, and Paul Murnock was on sound. That's it for me, Rick O'Shea. I will talk to you Monday night from 7, when we'll be talking to the producer of The Simpsons and the director of Broadcast News, Terms of Endearment and As Good as It Gets, James L. Brooks, about his first new film in 15 years, Ella McKay. We'll have art historian and author Katie Hessel on how to live an artful life. And as we celebrate 60 years of the film version of The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, we'll talk about that as well. John Creedon is next. Have a great weekend.